The Breakfast Club.
So when you see Adam White rock up and he's got the orange San Francisco Giants hat on, you know that it's going to be a day of energy, of inspiration, and a day of motivation. And today will be that day. Whitey, good morning to you.
Good morning, Daniel. I'm not sure if you know that a few years ago now I went to America. And
yet to hear that story.
Yeah, for my 40th birthday. And actually, that's not true. That was another time I went to America for my honeymoon.
I got it wrong.
I had this hat for a lot longer than I remembered. Went to the San Francisco Giants Stadium, and I
AT&T
purchased
Park?
This hat. AT&T Park, yes. Although
when you were married, it probably wasn't
AT&T.
No,
that's what it was.
Has it been there for that long?
Yep.
I don't know.
And I got this hat, so I don't actually support them, but I got the hat. And this morning, in a real sort of desperation type situation, I just got whatever I could find to wear, and that's what ended up on my head.
Well, it's okay. It's nice. Orange is my favourite colour.
It doesn't quite fit on the head properly, but anyway.
It's my favourite colour. So I'm more than happy with your SFG hat.
Now, I'm going to ask you a question straight off the top.
Okay.
Can you remember where you were on the 24th of September, 1993?
No, I cannot. Was I asleep?
You might well have been.
I've got a feeling I know where you're going.
Yeah?
Was that the announcement that Sydney was going to host the games?
Very good. And who announced that?
Well, Juan Antonio.
Very good.
My man.
Very good.
Or Jazz, as his friends call him, Juan Antonio Samaranch. Jazz, he's the Jazz man.
But the interesting thing is that I reckon most people will remember where they were when that announcement was made.
Well, I want to know if our listeners do, 0416905052. I don't.
but that's a $1.05 chance.
But that's not unusual.
No.
No, I don't. Wasn't it an overnight thing?
It was. You had to either be up really, really late or get up really, really early.
Yeah, well, that wasn't happening in 93. I was in year 11. You're in year 10.
School holidays. Because I remember I was playing golf that day at the Cowes Golf Club.
Of course you were.
I hit this sensational 7-iron from about 150 to 2 feet to an elevated green. It was a fantastic golf shot. It was easily in my top 10 shots of all time. Anyway, that's what I did that day. But we woke up to the news, or we got up early or stayed up late to the news that Sydney had won the Olympics.
Did you wake up, or were you alerted once you had been?
I reckon I was alerted. Because we were staying at a friend's house, a holiday house, and I think the intention was to stay up or whatever, but we just woke up to the news, I think.
Early doors off the SMS, no idea.
but my point of it was that back then it was such a massive announcement. Having, I guess, the heartache of Melbourne not winning the 1996 bid.
Yes. It's always up against it.
But we were led to believe we were the overwhelming favourites.
Yeah, we're going to get the World Cup too for 40
minutes. Yeah, and we got beaten by Atlanta. We didn't even get beaten by Athens for the Centenary Olympics.
That is true.
But in 2000, we beat another
Coca-Cola
city.
Money.
Yeah, exactly right. We beat another city in 1993 for the 2000 Olympics by just 2 votes. Can you remember who that city was that finished second?
Well, it certainly wasn't.
I know you don't like this sort of stuff.
No, I do. I do quite like it because it makes me think. It makes me try and tap into this memory that I'm sure is there somewhere. Barcelona.
No. Well, Barcelona, of course, had the Olympics in 92, so it was very, very
unlikely
that
they'll get there
again in 2000. Anyway, it was Beijing. But only 2 votes. So it was a very close call. This time round, there's not the same excitement. Now, is that because we weren't up against anybody, or is it because the Olympics have lost its luster, or because, I don't know. But it was or is it just an inevitability over the past 6 to 12 months that it was going to happen? It was just a matter of when? I'm not sure.
Well, I think there's a combination of all of those things. We knew it was going to happen. This is not news. Now, the official confirmation is always very nice to get, the rubber stamp and the tick of approval. The official tick of approval is nice. But we knew this was happening. And the other thing is, like I talked about last week regards to the Olympics, it's 11 years away. Like, we couldn't get excited about what's happening in Tokyo at the moment last week because it was a week away.
Yeah, that's a very good call. Yep.
So 11 years, and it's not exactly... For us, now obviously we've got listeners in Brisbane who would be cock-a-hoop this morning. But it's up there and they'll deal with it and then yeah. they'll do all their stuff and then they'll have the Olympics and it'll be awesome. In 11 years' time, I'll be really excited, I'm sure. But okay. I haven't got time to be excited right now about something that's going to take 11 years. I won't have a long-range Melbourne Cup bet because it's too far away.
I struggle to have a bet in a test match.
If I've got to wait that long, it's got to be something else I can do in between, is my theory. So that's yeah. that's my... I think there's an element of that. I think the element of it was going to be a foregone conclusion anyway. But it has been official. Brisbane will host the 2032 Olympics, although five delegates did vote no.
Yeah, I know.
Which was an intriguing part of the whole process. That's exactly right.
They just didn't like Brisbane. They were very anti-Brisbane.
There's no other contender,
yeah,
and they voted no.
Just because they could.
So they officially decided that nowhere would be better to have it.
Do you reckon there was any informal votes?
Well, there were three absentee votes, or not votes, absenteeisms. So there's 80 delegate votes, 77 voted, three decided or couldn't, decided they couldn't or wouldn't, whatever that means. 72-5 was the split, 72 yes, 5 no. I'm intrigued by the 5 no's. I'm intrigued by that, I must admit.
Did anyone vote Greens?
I think the...
Do you reckon some of the Scandinavian countries had Greens as preferences?
I'm not sure who the preferences were, but it is a very exciting day for Australian sport. There's no doubt about that. And Olympics is very exciting. It's very costly, but it does create great infrastructure and energy, and particularly around the area in the build-up to. Post is an interesting phase of Olympic movement, post the Games. But in the build-up, the opportunities and the energy that goes towards that and for sport in that region, wherever that might be, is a pretty cool thing. And we're sports people and sports fans, so that's a good thing.
And one of the benefits from just domestic sport will be that the Gabba will be transformed and it'll go a long way from where it used to be with the dog track and all those sorts of things. So there's clearly going to be benefits post the Olympics as well. I also wonder, sort of a bit from left field, that since the COVID situation, are we more territorial from a state perspective, that we're more... we have a more of a stronger allegiance to our state as opposed to our country? With the way borders get shut and protective of how each state is handling the COVID virus and all those sorts of things? I don't know.
Well, I think from a COVID situation, I think you're probably right. I'm not sure from a... Like if we're talking about Brisbane hosting the Olympic Games...
Yeah, so it'll be seen as Brisbane's Olympics as opposed to Australia's Olympics.
Yeah, well, I think today it's Brisbane's Olympics. But I think in time it'll be Australia's Olympics and we'll come around. As I said, it's 11 years away. Like, it's a long, long wait before we get, what was her name? What was the name of the Commonwealth Games? Big Kangaroo.
Matilda.
Matilda!
Yeah.
We'll get Matilda back out of the sheds and get her rolling along the track as part of the opening ceremony.
Do you think some children will come out of the pouch like they did in 98?
I'd be surprised if they didn't. if there's not a big twisted thong or a big giant thong from Sydney just making a reappearance... that'd be good to see as well. So Matilda and the thong, I'm keen to see that. I'm not sure who's putting the opening ceremony together yet, but I'm keen to see Matilda and the thong.
So we 32
not
years
in a thong and the thong.
32 years from Sydney to Brisbane, there was 44 years from Melbourne to Sydney.
It wouldn't be we've only got, how many states we got? 7?
Well, we haven't got that many. We've got 6
territories.
And 2 territories, I think it is.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, we've got 8, including territories.
6 and 2 territories.
Yeah. So to have 3 Olympics out of 8 is pretty good in the global sporting market.
Yep.
There wouldn't be too many countries that had that ratio of cities to Olympics.
No. I mean, some cities have had it 3 times, or will have had it 3 times, because LA and Paris are the two next, aren't they? And then
yes,
and then it's
Paris,
Brisbane.
LA.
Yeah,
but they're one of how many cities in the States, and how many cities in France?
Yeah, I don't know.
States and
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that either. Is it a question like that?
There's a text here that says it's that far away. My current 5-year-old daughter might be competing at it.
Well, that's right. I'll be 55, and I think that might just about see out my window.
Well, we'll see. I know my son Campbell might be able. Depends on whether what time of year it is. Exactly right. He's already ruled himself out of being drafted because it clashes with the IPL.
No, well, he'd be a future Australian captain. So
whether the Olympics are held in September or October, he might be a chance because it might be the off season for that sort of thing. Who knows? He might be playing Marsh Cup.
Marsh Cup. Goodness me. It's a very exciting day. Brisbane getting the Olympics 2032. It's not actually news, but it's confirmed.
Hmm.
And we think that's fantastic. So to all our Brisbane listeners, good luck to you for the next 11 years. And you're right about the Gabba. Although Anastasia, the Premier Palaszczuk, nearly buggered it up because she went early with the billion-dollar plan that she was requiring $500 million from the federal government for, which she hadn't told them about, which is it Ian Coates? Who's the AOC man? It is
John Coates.
John Coates, not Ian Coates.
Ian Coates was the former Carlton communications manager.
Too, the great Coatesy. John Coates said she almost blew it with that bold play announcing that to the media that she was going to get half a billion bucks from the feds without telling them. So that nearly buggered the whole thing. But we got there, so well done. Well done to all involved there.
What are your thoughts on Holly?
Who's Holly?
Holly's come up in some markets, $1.10, $1.25 for... The Bachelor.
Oh, no, Holly wins.
You reckon?
Yeah, you could. Well, you're not getting much value, but put it into a multi.
Yeah, she's short.
No, she wins.
It doesn't look a deep market this year.
She wins.
I'm notoriously
good at picking this from day one.
But that's because it's a fair bit of experience involved. Look, Hannah around $15 represents value. I thought the idea with the locket and throwing the key away had some merit.
No, I didn't
see
anything.
She seems very down to earth.
Let me tell you straight up, I didn't see anything, but I know. I looked at the pictures, which is all I need to do, and Holly's your winner.
Yeah, she was a bit low-key last night. Well, she was okay. I don't mind that. I don't mind the understated factor.
Well, you saw what happened to Gavin Wanganeen. He went hard early and played the nice guy and was all out.
Yes.
Third up, of course, not first.
Yeah, there's not a lot of depth to the field this year, though, and that's been represented in the markets, Daniel.
I'm sure that's right. So Holly should win The Bachelor. Put it into a multi, although you've got to wait a while. How long do we have to wait till we get an outcome there?
Wow. I mean, sort of Nick Quinn odds. Even Quinny said last night that he doubted that he would take those sort of odds.
I wonder what the odds were of the Milwaukee Bucks winning the NBA Finals when they were 2-0 down against Phoenix Suns in the best of seven series. But yesterday, after 50 years, they held the trophy aloft in front of a faithful as well, which is even better. Dario Melendez, host of Bally Sports Wisconsin, has been good enough to join us. One of the locals who I'm sure is partying like this 1999. Dario, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, last night here in Milwaukee, it was absolutely electric. I mean, Pfizer Forum was as loud as any arena I've ever been in. And the Deer District, which was built a few years ago with the hopes of hosting something like that, all the ideas came to fruition last night, and it was amazing. The city was awesome. There were people jumping into the river here. I don't know if that is condoned, but man, when you win a first title in 50 years, you're allowed to pretty much do anything you want.
Well, that's right. I mean, 50-year drought, and the last one, the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, was a part of it. It hasn't happened for so long, and the people of Milwaukee have been waiting for something exciting in terms of basketball for decades, clearly. I mean, and I saw out the front, or out in the Deer District there, 65,000 people were watching the game outside. I mean, it would have been amazing to be a part of it.
Yeah, it was crazy. Look, Peter Fagan, the president for the Milwaukee Bucks, this was kind of his brainchild, the Deer District. We had the Bradley Center, which was, it was built to be a hockey arena. And it looked like a hockey arena, it felt like one. You built Pfizer Forum a couple of years ago, this new state-of-the-art arena. You have a nice training center right across the street where they can practice and have state-of-the-art facilities. But you never really had like a place for fans to gather. And maybe we kind of saw this with what Toronto did a couple of years ago with their Jurassic Park area. But Peter Fagan was like, look, we have this land around here. Instead of having parking garages, why don't we put top-notch restaurants and bars and have a common place for the community to come and rally around? And it worked out great. I mean, the Deer District was the buzz of the nation just because of the way it was looking on TV. It looked great. The energy, the fans, it was a perfect storm of everything.
It's an amazing story. I mean, we talked about Giannis Antetokounmpo all the way through this and his season and certainly his finals campaign, the NBA Finals itself, where he's the finals MVP announced yesterday with his 50 points. But it's been a team built from scratch, basically. I mean, back in 2014 or 13 when he was drafted, Chris Middleton as well came in, and they could have gone and been part of super teams through the journey and got their titles, but they made a commitment to the city and to the team to build it and win it the right way. How satisfying is it from a fan's perspective to see it all unfold and finally come to fruition?
Oh, man. I mean, especially here in Milwaukee where, I mean, fans always feel like they're getting gut punched here. If it's not the Packers going to the NFC Championship and not getting all the way, the Brewers going to the NLCS and not being able to get to the World Series, then you have Giannis and Chris Middleton getting to the Eastern Conference Finals a few years ago, can't punch it through. And then you had all that talk in the offseason with, is Giannis going to sign? Is he not going to sign? Are the Bucks going to go out and get a point guard that can help complement them? We like Aaron Bledsoe, but he might not be the guy. So for Giannis to stay in Milwaukee, which is the smallest NBA market in the country, and not go and leapfrog somewhere else like Kevin Durant did, like LeBron James and Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade and all these other big names tend to do nowadays, for him to say, you know what, this is the team that drafted me in 2013. They're the team that came to Greece, gave a crud about me to actually scout me, took a chance on me, gave me this money, brought my family in, treat me like family. You know what, I'm going to return the favor. I'm going to stay here, and because I'm here, other players are going to want to come. And we saw that with Chris Middleton. We saw that with Drew Holiday. We saw that with P.J. Tucker. Off-season signings always want to come to Milwaukee now. And for that to happen here has just been absolutely epic. Epic, epic, epic.
So, Daria, tell us what it does to the city. You kind of touched on it, but considering what the world's been going through over the last 18 months or so with COVID, to be able to win at home, to see the crowd in the stadium, we're just watching the highlights actually now as we speak while we're talking to you. What does it do?
It was great. I mean, as you guys know, and I know Australia and New Zealand have been very strict, and there's a good reason for it. Wisconsin was one of the more stricter states in the U.S. It was just nice to be around people. Like, you always take that for granted. I mean, I took it for granted being around other individuals, like being able to share that common experience of just joy. You never really thought of it until it was all taken away from you for about a year. So the fact that they were able to get through COVID, and we were supposed to have the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee, which was going to be a huge economic boost for the city. With COVID, that went away. So obviously, financially, having a playoff run like this was huge for the bar district, for commercials, for restaurants, for all the entertainment businesses that were suffering during COVID. But then just for the citizens, the community itself, I mean, having a team that you can identify with, that has a superstar that has been through so much and is very relatable and loves being in the city, it just makes you happy. Like, that's really all you can say. Like I said, we had people climbing up light poles. We had people jumping in the river last night. It was a party all day long. We have a huge parade going tomorrow, going from the Art Museum down to the Deer District. So it's been a heck of a 2 months here.
Great to have the company of North Melbourne superstar ruckman in the sanctum today, Todd Goldstein, who is a world record holder, which we think is very, very exciting. Todd, good morning.
G'day, Hark. How you going?
I'm going well, mate. You're a world record holder. How do you feel about that?
Oh, look, mate, you know, we just got to... We've got to keep it, you know, calm and not get too ahead of ourselves. But, you know, there's plenty more free left in me. It was pretty cool to get that. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I've been aware of, that I was around the mark for the last probably 12, 18 months. And I think it's just something that I can, you know, look back on when I'm finished and enjoy with my family. And, you know, I think it just probably goes to my family and friends who have sacrificed a lot for me to do what I do. And, you know, I'm glad I can give them some joy along the way.
Well, you've done more than that through your journey. You've been a star, so that's not a problem at all. For those playing at home that may not be aware, that Todd has now the record number of hit-outs in Australian rules football history since statistics have been taken. So he is top of the tree, a world record holder as far as we're concerned, and that's very, very cool. You said that you're aware of sort of that stuff coming in or for the last little while. You are a real numbers nerd, or has someone alerted you to this business?
I was asked a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember exactly when it was. I remember whether it might have even been around my 200th when, I forget, I think it might have been Brad was coaching then, but I lose track of who was coaching at the time.
There's been a few through the journey.
It was brought up that I was I was second or third on the list, which made me look into it because I had no idea. And then I sort of saw it was in striking range, and I'm someone that takes a fair bit of pride in my craft and what I do. And you know, obviously, I've played a lot of games against Aaron, so I knew how dominant he was. So for me to be able to pick this up was pretty cool.
Did you know how many you needed in going into that game?
Yeah, I had the probably the worst 24 hours pre-game because I reckon I did about 5 or 6 interviews. I had probably 15, 20 texts from family members and friends congratulating me on breaking the record. And I was sitting there going, Streeth, I got 7 hit-outs to get here. If I don't get this, this would be pretty embarrassing. I was very aware that I only needed 7 going into the game, and was pretty relieved when I came off. And I think it was Heath O'Loughlin said, "Congratulations, you've got it."
Because I was going to ask you, were you counting them, and did you know the one that got you over the line? Because it was quite a crafty little sort of flick, the one that actually got you over the line. It was quite clever.
Yeah, well, most of my hit-outs aren't quite clever.
That's true. That is true.
I lose track. But I was hoping to count, but us ruckmen, you know, came to 7 is a big ask as well as anything else. So I thought I'd just leave it.
Yes, very good. Now, how do you think you're going? Because since we last spoke to you, the results have continued to be better, both in-game and also the from a scoreboard perspective. Are you now starting to get to the point now where, like the game against Essendon, where you had them on toast, you know, in that first half, that you're disappointed that you're not getting the win?
Absolutely. You know, I think the work that the entire group, the coaching staff, everyone's put in the first half of the season is really starting to pay off in this back end since the bye. And I think we've gone past the point now of really worrying about the effort and what side is going to turn up on the day. And we can now really focus in on the more nitty gritty stuff of where we're making mistakes in our system and where we're not executing our system well enough, which is a huge step for any side, I think, to take that. And, you know, we were obviously very, very disappointed because I think we all felt like we could have been 4 or 5 goals up at half time against Essendon. It would have been a very, very different game rather than the 10 points or whatever it was. So, yeah, we're definitely disappointed, but, you know, I think we can all see that we're heading in the right direction, and we just need to keep tightening up our systems and understanding the way we want to play and doing it for the 4 quarters.
Have you done anything different, Todd, in the last 4 or 5 weeks, or maybe even just since the bye, that's seen this almost rapid improvement, or is it just the natural improvement that's coming as you're getting used to the new game style, getting used to a new coach, and just the, I guess, the organic development of everyone?
Yeah, well, I think it was probably naive for us to think that we were going to come into round one after pretty much a month and a half pre-season and be 100% across a game plan brought in by a completely new coaching group. So I think it's got to give credit to the coaches we've got, and we've got someone like a Heath Uni who's got that teaching background. I think that's made a huge difference to this group to be able to understand how to introduce the plans and what they want us to do and do that gradually. So I think it comes down to the way the coaches have introduced the game plan, understand probably the most important bits we need to understand first, and have slowly, you know, incorporated new bits and pieces to give us a little bit more of an attacking edge. I think it's just that work, that slow build. It was going to take time, and probably that 2 weeks around the bye that we had was where we really went to work on hard education, and that's made a huge difference.
The performance against West Coast over there was brilliant in difficult conditions, Todd. My concern was going to be, leading into last week's game, that when you have those wins with a team that's developing, emerging, sometimes it's hard to come down from the high and you never really back it up. But your first half on the weekend was outstanding. Were you worried about that going in? Was that spoken about coming into the game against the Bombers?
Not really, to be honest. I think in a normal circumstance you might be a little bit worried about that, but with the week that we had leading to that Bombers game, we had a fair bit going on.
Yeah.
I don't think we really had time. We sort of enjoyed the win that night after the game, but once we got back to Melbourne, I think we were in Melbourne for 24 hours, and then the Thursday morning we got an email saying we had a meeting at 9 a.m. to come in, and then we found out we were leaving in an hour to go to Brisbane. So we didn't really have time, I don't think, to process too much stuff. We just sort of went about our routines as much as we normally could, and and play the game that way. And I think the expectation now for us is that the effort and the way we played against the West Coast Eagles is the bare minimum. That's what we expect from ourselves each week. And I think we're starting to get that.
So what happened in the second half? What was identified in the review about what went wrong in the second half against the Bombers?
Oh, we probably shot ourselves in the foot, as we said early on that first half, and we didn't take our opportunities. And then Essendon were obviously good enough to come at us, and we just made too many mistakes in terms of how we want to defend and how we want to attack. And you know, good sides will hurt you when they get opportunities. So I think that was the main thing, was just a bit more consistency in playing our way.
And when you got on the plane, or you were told you had an hour to get onto the plane, did you think you'd be staying in Queensland, or were you told at that time that you would be coming straight back after the game?
No, we had no idea. So I think we got out of the meeting about 10 o'clock, and we were pretty much told that we could be going for 4 days, we could be going for 3 weeks. We weren't too sure, and you had about 15 minutes to talk to your family and make a decision on whether you're going to come based on what was best for you and your family. So that was a bit of a whirlwind, 15 minutes trying to call our wives and our partners. And then we pretty much had about an hour to pack our bags, and we were told to pack for at least 3 weeks and pack for Brisbane and pack for Tassie, which is a really different climate.
Couldn't get more contrasting.
That's right.
Yeah, so we had a fair bit of baggage when we left. We didn't find out we were coming back to Melbourne until late Saturday night before the game.
Right. So take us through that conversation with the partners. Well, not all of them, just yours. Because we've heard about the Giants and Sydney getting their families up in quarantine in Queensland at the moment so that they can spend some time together after being apart for a while. And not knowing how long you're going to be, how does that conversation go, Todd?
I'm pretty lucky. My wife is got a sporting background. She sort of understands the situation we're in and understands that, you know, that the best thing for me and my football was to go. But it was just making sure that she had the support with, you know, with two kids under 18 months at home. It was really important that we had the right support around her, and we were lucky that her parents are around the corner from us at the moment. So we made that decision based on the fact that she had support, and you know, let's hope it was only 4 days, but you know, for 3 weeks, it's in the scheme of life, it's not a long time. So we felt like that we could get through that period, and it was a difficult one. I think I was probably struggling more with the decision than she was, but yeah, you know, it's one of those things that I felt like I had a responsibility to the team and to the footy club to get on the plane, and that's what I did.
I understand that everyone copes with this differently, but as an experienced player, but a family man as well, how is it stuffing with your mind a bit, this uncertainty about where you're going to be, and is it a concern that it might have an effect on your footy, or is everyone just taking it in its stride or in their stride?
Well, I think this point of the season is probably very different to the way it was last year. I think, I mean, for us, we know we're not playing finals, so we know that we've got 5 weeks left, less than 5 weeks left now. So even if we did have to move states for the remainder of the season, it's not going to be an overly long period of time.
Yep.
So I think that probably helps you mentally understand it. So I knew that, you know, obviously last year we left being told we're going to be gone for 35 days and ended up being 82 or whatever it was. Whereas this year you sort of go, even if the 3 weeks became the rest of the season, it was only going to be 2 more weeks. And you never know, they might have introduced shorter breaks and things like that. So mentally it was okay, but you know, leaving your family for a few weeks is at the drop of a hat is a tough thing to get your head around. But you know, I think for me, I was understanding of why I made the decision, and that makes it easier.
There's one player I wanted to ask you about, Todd, before we let you go, and that's Cam Zerha. And you know, early in the season, he was really struggling. He just didn't seem to be the player, or even the person that we're used to seeing with that confidence and bit of bravado and the way he plays his footy. He's got back to that. Can you share with us a little bit about his journey this year? I know he's opened up a little bit publicly, but it's just great to see him back playing the footy that we all know he can play.
Yeah, I think Cam was probably judged quite harshly early on the season because he wasn't kicking goals, but he was doing a lot of unselfish team play, giving off some goals and things like that that we were all seeing and understanding where he was at early on. And I think it was really important for the whole group to make sure we were recognising the unselfish way that, Cam was playing. We knew that the goal would eventually come. But I think for him, you know, he talks about, you know, getting his dog is a real turning point for him. But, you know, I think for a lot of players, it is that opportunity to have to grapple with, have to take care of something else other than yourself, can really be a growth in your maturity and the way you go about your life. And I think that is probably fairly true with Cam this year. And, you know, since obviously getting that dog, he's been a lot freer in his mind. He's been a lot freer on the field and really performing. And as soon as you play a couple of good games in a row, I think that confidence starts to build and you stick to those processes. And I think that's what we're seeing with Cam now.
It's amazing what a dog can do to someone. And I'm not trying to be facetious. They just take the focus off you, because you know, you've got to come home and you've got to look after something and have responsibility for something else. And all of a sudden, your world just opens up a little bit and your mindset opens up a little bit about your spot in it, Todd.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, for me, you know, I think my career really took off when I had kids. And you know, you realise that you're playing for something more than just yourself. And that really can make a huge difference. So, you know, I think we're all enjoying what Cam's doing. And you know, if you need to get another dog, we're all for that.
Footy clubs are notorious going through phases of dog ownership. Is this a trend at the moment at the Kangaroos? Are there a couple sort of new ones floating around?
Yeah, it is. At the moment, it seems like players are either getting dogs or kids. So, it is a theme that's coming up. And, yeah, a lot of young boys like to stick together.
The Aussies are over in the Windies at the moment with their white ball campaign, but the Australian domestic summer was announced yesterday, and it's a good chance to touch base with Chris Rogers, the coach of the Victorian Sheffield Shield team, who's been good enough to join us today. Good morning, Buck.
Morning, Harp. How are you?
I'm well, mate. Nice to have you back on the program. It's been a while. Have you been well?
Very good, thank you. Haven't had too many winters in Melbourne, to be honest, so... Yeah, it's been an experience, hasn't it? But it's great to be.
Well, you get to know the inside of your house these days. So that's the good part. You found nooks and crannies you never knew existed in winter in Melbourne. Don't worry about that. How excited were you? Were you pumped? Did you go through a forensic comb of the fixture yesterday? It was announced for the Shield Summer and the Marsh One Day Cup as well when it was announced?
Oh, it's good to just have them out, really, and we can get into the planning. I guess there's been a lot going on with everything that's happening in the world, and also you know, that trying to get these fixtures out, it's been a bit of a challenge for the people who've been responsible for it. But there is a lot going on, so just grateful it's happened, and hopefully, you know, it can go ahead and this virus doesn't cause too many more problems for us.
So it kicks off on September 28th, the Shield season. Victoria play New South Wales to open the season at the City Power Centre at the Junction Oval. What's the planning like from you for now? I mean, have you had an inkling of what it would look like from a timeline perspective and been able to plan accordingly, or is this all new information?
No, we've had a bit of an idea what that looks like. This is really a second draft, so we play a couple of one-day matches originally on September 11th and 15th. So we have a few games planned against New South Wales before that. We'll be preparing for that. And then following that, it's a bit of a two-week break where, we're leading into the Shield. So there'll be some Red Bull preparation leading into the season. But, probably that 2 week break after the one day games, there'll be it'll be full on, because it's a fair bit of cricket that comes up pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So Chris, having six Shield games before any Test matches is played, how beneficial is that for whether it be a James Pattinson, a Marcus Harris, or a Will Pekowski to get a good base in at domestic level?
Yeah, morning, Whitey. It's probably, the great thing is there's enough games there that if you're good enough, you'll find a way. If it was one or two games, you could easily just miss out on it with a couple of good deliveries if you're a batsman, or a couple of bad decisions, or a couple of drop catches if you're a bowler. So over the length of six games, you think that the cream will rise to the top, and hopefully we'll see a number of the Victorian players putting their hand up for Australian selection.
So from a point of view of where you're at the moment, just for our listeners, give a bit of an insight as to how long you've been back in pre-season training. There's obviously a sort of a scattered approach from the youngsters through to the seniors. You've got your captain playing over in Middlesex at the moment. So how do you bring it all together?
Yeah, it's been a challenge. There's a lot of moving parts at this stage. I guess from my point of view and knowing what it was like to be a senior player, I actually didn't do many pre-seasons, to be honest, Whitey, but I think there's a lot of responsibility putting into them that they can really take care of themselves. They know what they need to do to prepare. And we can really put a lot of focus on the younger guys. We have a big group of probably inexperienced players, almost two-thirds of the squad, really. So we've put a lot of focus on them, developing them, not just in the nets, but, you know, kind of sitting down and trying to understand the game a bit more. And that'll flip once the season starts. There'll be, you know, more probably put more on the senior players because they're going to be our main players. So everyone seems to understand that those concepts. And at the moment, there's you know, it's a really good feeling amongst the squad. And hopefully we can carry into that the first game and beyond.
Well, there seems to be a bit of a shift in the philosophy from Cricket Australia, Buck, about what the Sheffield Shield is and what it should look like from a format perspective and just some of the way it's projected. There's no day-night games anymore. There was for a couple of years. There hasn't been for in the recent years. But there's no day-night pink ball games. And now, after a trial with the Duke's ball for one half of the season and the Kookaburra for the other, they're going back to the Kookaburra full-time now. Is this the right way? And why the change, do you think?
Look, I think there's value in all those things that you're talking about, Harf. It's probably what they see as the right thing to do. With the juice ball, it's great in terms of, you know, getting our players to be able to play swinging ball, use a swinging ball. But equally, we found that, you know, the spinners just didn't come into the game. And if you look at the schedule for the Australian team over the next, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, there'll be a whole heap of matches played in Asia. So, you know, that ability to play spin is really going to come to the fore, and bowl spin, to be honest. Mm. So I think that's been a bit of a focus, really. We've got to get back to being able to have awareness around spin in our game, and that's probably one of the reasons they've done it. The day and night games, I'm not too sure why. Maybe even a similar concept, but yeah, that's the way they've decided to go.
And from a Victorian perspective, with the One Day Cup leading into the Shield, will we see some opportunities given through that One Day Cup to develop some players and see whether or not they've got what it takes for you to want to put them into the Shield, or will you just have a sort of a one-team format and see what happens?
I think the teams will slightly vary between the One Day Cup and Shield cricket. I think, you know, as we go along, it's becoming more and more specialised. However, I think last year we probably got caught on the hop a little bit with the amount of cricket we had to play in the back half and the need to rest players at times because they just wouldn't have been able to manage the load. So, but this year, I think, this season, I think there's a bit more in terms of space, in terms of the gaps. So I'm pretty sure we'll be able to play, you know, nearly our strongest side in most games. So if that means playing the senior players, then so be it. No doubt there will be opportunities for younger players because if you look at our squad, you know, we've got so many of them. So at some stage we're going to have to play younger players and even opportunities for other people outside our squad if they can put up their hands and push for selection, who knows what will happen.
The Agar brothers playing for Australia in the squad for Australia for the one day. Wes got the chance to be a part of the action, and Ashton was in fact carrying the drinks, but very importantly, presented him with his cap, which was pretty cool. Let's have a listen to how some of it went down in the West Indies yesterday.
I'm starting in our backyard in South Avenue, playing backyard cricket with Will and I. Playing for McKinnon, junior cricket club. Playing with Will. playing with him there with your gut hanging out over your thigh pad sometimes. Some photos of that. Mum, Dad, Will and I are so proud of you. I love you so much.
There's a fair bit of emotion in that from Ashton as he presented the Australian cap to brother Wes. And I wonder how Father John was feeling about that, watching it all unfold. He's been good enough to join us. John Agar, welcome to The Breakfast Club.
G'day, how are you going?
We're going all right, thanks. When you hear that and that audio from Ashton as he presented the cap to Wes, how do you feel? How does the family feel when all that unfolds?
Oh, gee, there's a lot of emotion there. And I watched with a tear in my eye and... It was amazing, yeah. I think that, you know, the boys are really close, and I think for Ash to be able to present his cap to him was a big deal, and, yeah, I kind of expected that, really. The boys love each other, don't
they? Yeah, he talked about that post in another interview at Cricket Website, that you're a really tight family, and you would have known that it was half a chance to happen when Wes was on the plane to the Windies, but having two sons representing their nation, can you believe what's happening?
Well, I remember the interview when Ash played his first test match, and one of the commentators said to me, gosh, well, one of the other boys ever played for an Australian. I said, that'll be a dream come true, wouldn't it? A few years later, here we are. So, look, it's just amazing. It's, you know, they're all pretty good cricketers, all three of them, actually, and I've got another son, Will, and the two of them have gone on to play for Australia, and, you know, we're a super proud family. We're just really proud. I mean, you know, I was emotional yesterday as well, so just chock-a-block full of nervous energy. I had a headache last night.
John, I want to ask you about the sacrifices that the boys have made, because we were talking about it yesterday, just about Ashton having to go over to Western Australia to try and further his career, get out of his comfort zone to get opportunities, and then his brother Wes having to do a similar thing, having to go across to South Australia. I mean, they've made incredible sacrifices to get to this point. Can you share a little bit of that as a father, what they've gone through?
I mean, both boys really could have played in Victoria. Victoria was very good to them, and they both really offered contracts. I think, you know, in professional sport now, you go where you can get a game, and we can get a game reasonably early, and I think they both made those decisions based on that. It's hard because we've got three boys, and like I said, they're all close together. But moving away from home and doing what they've had to do, it's hard. You know, it's probably the same as the footballers these days. But they've been successful at what they've done. And they've got games, and I guess it's games under your belt, and getting an opportunity is what it's all about. And then taking the opportunity. But you know, there's no easy road. They work hard, and, you know, good luck to them. It's a hard road, but they've done well. And then they have to go and play for their country, and it seems harder again. So... but, yeah, they have made sacrifices. So I've got one boy at home, I've got one in South Australia, one in Western Australia. And so they're not together anymore. They were as little ones. Because I had three boys under four, so they're all fairly close in age and all very close. But now they're in different states. I think sometimes that separation, that distance makes it a little hard. But it just means that when they're together, they have a really, really good time. So, and we were able to do that recently when Ashton got married. So. Yeah, they have made sacrifices to go and play, but they play under wonderful coaches, under wonderful state systems. They're well looked after, and we can't ask for any more as parents, really. So, you know, yeah.
Do you forecast it gets a bit easier to watch now that you've got through the first one with Wes?
Yeah. It was really getting through the first three balls. And, you know, you just... I don't know. Like any parent who watches a kid playing sport, you just want them to run in and you want them to do well. And you want the team to win. You want them to be able to sing the song at the end of the game. And, you know, just the whole big deal. And it gets broadcast worldwide. So I think, yeah, nervous energy is the way to say. I often say to my friends, you know, when Ash plays, I hide behind the couch and watch with one eye. And, you know, I say to people, yesterday, how can I watch it with no eyes open? I said, it's going to be pretty tough. It's just you're full of nervous energy. And I thought he did really well. And, you know, he bowled good lines and lengths and did what he had to do, and he didn't get taken down by some of the biggest hitters in the world, and so it was good. It was fun. It was we make a big song and dance, and we got lots and lots and lots of messages come through on the phone, things like that. So the whole cricket family, if you want to call it that, around Australia, all the people we know in Melbourne, they all wished him well. And so, I guess watching from outside, people say, oh, he's been picked for, played for Australia. That's good. But inside, we're all jumping around and having a great time.
Very much looking forward to seeing what happens at Marvel Stadium 145 on Saturday when the Blues host the Kangaroos, part of the Blues lineup. Coming off a knee, Rico, this year, and is doing a hell of a job too, is Nick Newman, who joins us on the program this morning. Hello, Newey.
G'day, guys. How are you?
We are well. We are well. How are you? How are you coping with all this? You're back in footy. You missed last year with your Rico through a tumultuous period with the whole COVID situation. You're back playing week in, week out. How are you feeling?
Mate, I'm good. Yeah, I'm great. Obviously, it's really nice to be playing footy every week. And compared to last year, I was up in the hub and, doing my rehab. So, I'm loving playing footy, mate. And look, we'd love to have a crowd there at the moment. But for me, I'm just enjoying being back in the routine of playing footy every week, mate. So, I'm really enjoying it. Good to be back, and body's feeling pretty good. So, happy days.
Nick, is it more around in terms of your comeback now and playing some good footy? Your last nine games have been back to that level of 2019. Is it more confidence in your body and your knee, or has it been a combination of just finding your way, your skills again, and your touch with playing?
Yeah, I think you summed it up, Brad. It's a combination of both for me. There's always the physical side of it, and I'm lucky enough to have a great medical team around me and one of the best in Andrew Russell, so I felt like I was as prepared as I could have been. But ultimately, as you guys know, that first quarter or that first game when you play, you're pretty gassed. So a little bit of finding my feet with the physical side of things, but the touch and the skills and the speed of the game as well. And I was out of the game for over a year, which is a significant time. So there's also the feeling of, have I still got it? Has the game gone past me? All those little things. So, it was a little bit around finding my feet again out there. And I feel like I'm pretty comfortable back out there at the moment. So, still think I could improve a fair bit over the last five games. But, it's been nice to sort of settle back in and start to get used to it again.
And I guess also, Nick, you've had that opportunity to play that role that had been left by Sam Docherty. Obviously, you'd want Sam out there, but it was almost like, well, we need you to play a really important role. Away you go and do what you know you can do.
A little bit. Me and Doc seem to sort of be tag-teaming a little
bit. Yeah, that's right.
He's injured, I'm out there, and when I'm out there, he's injured. So, it'd be nice to string some games together because I really do enjoy playing with Doc, and he's got a great footy mind. So, a little bit of that role I've taken up, but I think this year compared to 2019 is, Zach Williams and Adam Starr, who are similar in a sense in terms of their rebounding and attacking flair. So I think it's, Doc as a leader. We're lucky we've got some strong leaders down there with Weeders and Jonesy, so that's probably spread a little bit, and then the attacking side of it and his role is probably spread between a few of us. But, I have probably taken up a little bit of that role with him being out.
Nick, I really think on last week's performance against the Pies, a real maturity to grind out after quarter time and finish the way that you did. What was the assessment from David Teague? Because when you look at the way you finish the game and the games you've got coming up, destiny's in your own hands in terms of potential finals performance this year. How did he assess that performance, and what's he looking at from you guys as a team to strive towards some finals in 2021?
Yeah, look, the assessment of the game was probably a tale of two halves, really. We felt like the first half was well and truly on Collingwood's terms, and we weren't playing sort of our brand of footy. We were probably sitting back a bit. We weren't pressing the ground, keeping the ball in our front half. And I think probably with about 6 or 7 minutes to go in the second quarter when Jack Martin laid that big tackle in the middle of the ground. We got a goal from it. That was probably the catalyst for it. And, yeah, and then the second half, we were really pleased. That's sort of the brand of footy we want to play. We're really hard and contested on the inside, which our mids did a great job. But once we got it in our front half, we sort of pinned it there. We limited their inside 50s to, I think, 15 or 16. So, yeah, that was really pleasing from our point of view. And I suppose the messaging going forward is doing that for four quarters. You know, we were lucky enough to do it for a half and get away with the result. But that's not going to get your result every week doing it for a half. So if we can do it for as close to four quarters as possible, then we think we'll get a result most weeks.
Newey, tell us about Ed Curnow. He brings up game number 200 this week. He's a much-loved clubman. Is Ed. He's a very popular player. He's been second in the BNF for the last couple of years, I think it is. He's all over the place. But he's one of those glue-type players, they tell me down there at the Blues. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's a star, Ed. I love what he does on field, obviously, as everyone does. He's a, a heart and soul player of the Carlton Footy Club. He gets his hands dirty, that's for sure. He's an ultimate team man. He plays whatever roles asked for him, whether that's on a forward flank as a midfielder, on a wing, whether it's tagging. He's been an incredible player. I think it's probably been underrated how good a player he's been. I think I read yesterday he's been top three in the BNF for the last 3 years, and I think he might have been one of the only players to do that apart from Juddy. So that in itself is an amazing achievement on field. But, off field, he's, as you know, half like I don't even have a word to describe him. He's just a character. Like, I've never met anyone like him before. He's he's got so much energy. Like, he just bounces around the club. Like, he can't sit still. But he's an amazing club person. I think he's won best club in one or two times. And even, the admin staff upstairs rave about him, that he's up there and always checking in on him. He knows everyone's name at the club. He's one of those guys that you just love having at your footy club, because he gives everything on field, but off field he's just a genuine bloke and such a good person. And, a wonderful club person. So, really looking forward to celebrating his 200th. And I love playing in milestone games. I can't wait, and hopefully we can get a result for Redder. But, he's an individual, that's for sure.
Now, Nick, speaking of characters, you got the new locker room. You're in between Zach Fisher and Jacob Weedery. I just want to know how that dynamic works. That's really important that you're settled with your roomies, either side of you.
I'm pretty set up. I've probably got polar opposites either side of me in Fish and Weeders. But I love it because it balances it out a bit. I love both sides of them, but, I probably couldn't get two more opposite blokes at a footy club. I love them. Weeders, probably he's been a bit stiff. He's got the locker right next to the door that everyone walks in, and he was a bit flat with that, and they've probably given it to the bloke with the widest shoulders at the club, so he cops a few elbows walking through every morning, so he was flat about that. And the boys let him know about it as well.
That is true. It's a shocking spot, that. Absolutely shocking spot in the locker room.
Yeah. It's not good.
and Ed's brother, Charlie, going back to that for a second, is he going to play this week? Or what's Charlie's program, do you know?
I'm not entirely sure. He got through about 60% game time on the weekend of a sort of scratch match. So, all that stuff's out of my hands. But, it would be great for him to play in Ed's 200, but I don't think they'll change his course at all because of that. I think they'll stick to the process of whatever they were planning to do. But, it's just great to see him back playing footy. I spent a bit of time with him in rehab, and he's along the same lines of Ed in terms of he's got so much energy and he's bouncing around. So for someone that's of that nature to, not be able to run and play footy and do what he loves for over 2 years now was pretty hard for him. And, me and him spent a fair bit of time in rehab, so we had a bit of bonding to do. So, it was just awesome to see him back, mate, and jumping for marks. And can't wait to have him back playing in the AFL team, whenever that is. But, he's going to be a pretty handy player to chuck back in hopefully at some stage it's here.
Honours lead by four. And now they lead by ten. Jake Stringer with his fourth goal.
He's doing that willy-nilly these days, Jake Stringer. He's having a great year for the Bombers and yesterday signalled his intent to be a part of the rebuild for the long term. 3 years extra for Jake and the Bombers, as contract announced yesterday, and he joins us on The Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Jake.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good on you, buddy. Nice to have you with us. Is it nice to get that out of the way?
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. Especially getting towards the silly season. You always want it to be done before that, so yeah, really relieved.
Were you ever considering not being at Essendon next couple of years?
Mate, to be honest, it didn't even cross my mind that I was going to end up anywhere else. And that's speaking honestly the truth, and my management would vouch for that. There was never any doubt that I was going to go anywhere else.
That's categoric. That is categoric. Couldn't be more emphatic.
Hey, Jake, I'm interested, before I let Jono have a good chat to you, just the change in the footy club with, obviously Ben Rutten coming in, Josh Marnie as footy manager. It feels a different place. And so you've been part of the old and the new Essendon. Can you explain the differences and the confidence that the team have got out of those changes?
Yeah, I suppose it's just been one of those things that last year we were really building something, but we were just weren't getting the results on the footy field. And then when Ben took the reins at the start of this pre-season, it was a new start for everyone, and that's sort of how everyone took it. You look at our defence, three quarters of them were playing in the forward line with me last year, and they're all having breakout seasons. So, it's just been one of those things that Ben's come in and put a lot of trust into people to play different positions, and the people have grabbed them with both hands.
And Jake, what is it with yourself in terms of, you just seem more comfortable now that if the forward line's not working for you, your game's not lost, or if you haven't started well in the mid, you're still not lost on the game for four quarters, you go forward and have an impact. How has that growth come about within your performance? Is that back to Ben Rutten?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part with Ben Rutten, and also Blake Carosella as well, giving me more time and more opportunity in the midfield as well, giving me the freedom that, if things are a bit stale for me up forward, that I can go up to the midfield and have a run around and try and have an impact and then go back forward. So that's just been something that, we've really found a nice little groove over the last 6 to 7 weeks.
Jake, you got looking at the last four games, you had Adelaide and North, you expected to win those games. Melbourne and Geelong, you lost those games. But what did you learn from playing those real contenders for this year on where Essendon's growth needs to come for the remainder of this year, with finals are still a chance, but also for the years to come?
Yeah, I mean, they're the games that you want to be in against, and they're the teams that you need to be beaten to be any chance in September. And at the minute, we're not quite there, but we're getting great, strong belief in the performance and the efforts we're putting out against the top teams, that it's not too far away, and we seem to be getting closer and closer to a victory against one of them, and that's all it is, mate. We're on a journey. We've got five or six players that have played their first games this year, so it's really exciting, and we're building something, and we're putting a lot of hard work in, and we're just not quite at the top of the tree yet, and we probably won't be for a little while yet.
Jake, we were talking about you on the program, I think half was earlier this week, about your journey from being such a dynamic footballer at the Bulldogs and then losing all form and then obviously ending up not being at the Bulldogs and now at Essendon, and now you're back to where you were when you were such a dominant player in the game. Were you always confident you'd get back to the levels you're at now? You've had a lot of injuries as well to be thrown into the mix, but the footy you're playing now, you're back to your best.
Yeah, I mean, I never, lost faith that I couldn't get back there, but it was just one of those periods where I probably wasn't enjoying my football all that much. And at the time, you probably think you are, but it's not until, you take a step back from everything. And, that's probably been the best thing about Ben coming in and just giving that fresh new start for me and really believing in me. I suppose that's probably been the biggest thing, that I can play in the midfield, and I had a really big pre-season too, which also helps coming off ankle surgery, you know, midway through last year and dealing with that. And, yeah, I sort of set myself up for a big year this year, which has been nice to sort of get some reward for that.
If there was a blank coach's board in front of you and your magnet in your hand, Jake, where would you put it?
Anywhere that's not in the defensive 50.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.